So now that we're settling into great silence, wanted to bring up a couple of points of our training. Usually in Japan, trainees who are basically kids, they get each person gets one tatami mat, so about this much space. And especially new trainees, that's about all they have. They have a tatami mat and a kind of a pair of cupboards about twice that big for all of their stuff, including their bedding. The lower part is full of bedding. The upper part is where they put everything else, all their clothes and so forth. And the top is bare. You're not allowed to put anything on top even, although it's this perfectly nice open space. So it's a little difficult, you know, for us Westerners who were there. They actually allowed us quite a bit more space, although one of the supervisors did tell me, no, you shouldn't have stuff on top of your cupboard. And I thought, okay. And then he relented and said, well, sutra or something, okay, but not like socks. Okay, right. This kind of boxing us in is it's like a grindstone. As a result, it's a little uncomfortable. And we don't do that here so much, but we do it a little bit. And I was kind of hoping I could ask us to do it a little bit more. So most of us sitters now, we have like a half a tatami, so we got half as much as they do in Japan. But another kind of boundary is the, you know, the kind of invisible boundary of personal space. And when we're sitting together and practicing together with some intensity, it's quite easy to get sort of casual about that. And sometimes in retreat settings, you'll see someone who has a bunch of stuff and it's kind of all over the place and kind of in someone else's, on someone else's tatami. And also it's very easy to be casual about sound and movement in the zendo. So it seems very simple to us to, you know, when we're in our ordinary life, to make a certain amount of noise and move a certain amount without reflecting. But in this space, in a training space like this, everything makes a difference. So what we're actually asked to do is to bring all of our gestures of body, speech, and mind inside the practice vessel, and not assume that motions or sounds that we make are just somehow, they don't count. So it actually does make a difference, you know, when we cough or sneeze, sound or expression have a feeling of practice about it. So we shouldn't like cough or sneeze, and of course sometimes we have to, I certainly do, casually. We shouldn't make noise with our breath, even though it may seem so natural to, you know. Well, I don't think I've noticed anybody doing this yet. I have on occasion, someone will stand up from Zazen and kind of go, you know. Stay inside this space. There's a reason for that. There's a reason for this confinement, because subtly but vigorously defended boundaries of the self become illuminated by that kind of practice. You really start to see how you project into the world and how much space you actually take up, especially when you stop, you try to withdraw energy from kind of habitual expressions. For instance, I'm sure I have some. Usually when I'm by myself, like I'll hum sometimes or talk to myself. So I don't do any of that in the Zendo. I don't drum my fingers. It's not very much. When I cough, I try to make it, you know, this is a practice cough. Sounds different. Practice sneeze. Sounds different. Sometimes people will like, you know, they'll sigh. You know, big sigh. It's like, well, so what? But actually, this is projecting something about our state into the world and kind of throwing it out of the container to be received and perhaps admired or despised by the audience. One of my teachers at UC, Jim Matisoff, a linguist, wrote a very entertaining paper called Psycho-Ostensive Expressions in Yiddish. Psycho-ostensive expressions are expressions whose purpose is nothing other than to express the state of the person. And I'm afraid I don't remember, there are a lot of them, but I only remember like Eugefalt is one very common one, but there are lots of others. And all they do is say where you're at. And this is a wonderful function of the human being, but in the training environment, particularly in retreat, we try to shrink that space that we take up. So I guess I would ask us, please be very conscious of gesture and sound and how you are arranging yourself in the space of your little half-tatami retreat cave there. So please be very sensitive to that and realize that they're actually all of these acts of body, speech, and mind have a bearing and affect the retreat container, the retreat space. Okay. Any questions about that? Eugefalt. I'm not sure what that means, but it must be like jeepers. Along those lines. So this is all so that we can continue our cultivation and clarification of the mind ground, so-called. You know about the mind ground? Yesterday I was reading a little bit from Master Fayan Wanyi, 10th century progenitor of the House of Fayin. So I thought I'd read a little bit more of that and see what you think. One of Master Fayin's few writings is his 10 guidelines for Chan schools. So I thought I'd share some of those with you. Here's his preface. I shed the cage of entanglements in youth and grew up hearing the essentials of the teaching traveling around, calling on teachers for nearly 30 years. The Chan schools in particular are widespread, most numerous in the South. Yet few in them have arrived at attainment. Such people are rarely found. Anyway, even though noumenal principle is a matter for sudden understanding, actualities must be realized gradually. The teaching methods of the schools have many techniques, of course, but insofar as they are for dealing with people for their benefit, the ultimate aim is the same. If, however, people have no experience of the doctrines of the teachings, it is hard to break through discrimination and subjectivity. Galloping right views over wrong roads, mixing inconsistencies into important meanings, they delude people of the following generations and inanely enter into vicious circles. I have taken the measure of this, says Fa Yin, and it is quite deep. I have made an effort to get rid of it, but I have not fully succeeded. The mentality that blocks the tracks just grows stronger. The intellectual undercurrent is not useful. Where there are no words, I forcefully speak out. Where there is no dogma, I strongly uphold certain principles. Pointing out defects in Chan schools, I briefly explain 10 matters using words critical of specific errors to rescue an era from decadence. So, as I said, this is from the early Song Dynasty. But this complaint about the decadence of practice can be heard every generation. This is nothing new. Nor is the claim that although practitioners of Chan can be found lots of places, few have arrived at attainment. We also hear this every generation. Noumenal principle is a matter for sudden understanding, but actualities are realized gradually. This is, I think, this is our experience. Noumenal principle, mind, ground, reality, things as they are. Emerges brightly in the body-mind without contrivance. But the particularities, as he says here, the actualities, they must be dealt with bit by bit, step by step. So even though each of us is alight with Buddha nature, the particularities of our situation and our practice have to be dealt with courageously, compassionately, and carefully. I think this is pretty commonly our experience. Now, all our teaching methods are for helping others. This may not be so obvious when we're talking about cramming ourselves onto one tatami. Maybe that doesn't seem like something for helping others, but I would say the more experience we have, the more that becomes clear that actually it is helpful to be able to see, in a manner of speaking, the frantic borders of the self, provisional self. To see that as, it's not really a border, actually, it's a kind of habitual activity, which can be sometimes quite frenetic, other times not so much. And as the intensity of that activity decreases, the world as it appears reveals itself to us differently. So one of the great functions of retreat, of course, is to live in such a way that that activity at the border quiets down, revealing a wider universe, revealing, you might say, noumenal principle, which dawns on us directly. He says here, you know, if people don't understand the doctrines, they don't have the any grasp of the teaching, then it becomes very difficult to speak to their subjectivity or our subjectivity in a way that's helpful. So here's a master of the Chan school who is not repudiating doctrine at all. In fact, he's saying doctrine is how our often how our habitual subjectivity is initially challenged. I think that's pretty true. I think in my experience, what started me questioning deeply my assumptions about the world and body and mind was hearing something about Buddha's teaching. A doctrine, if you like. For instance, the teaching that there is no abiding self. Further, that persons and objects are without abiding self. And that failure to clarify that is the source of suffering. Now that's, I'd say that's doctrine. And when we encounter that, our habit of subjectivity is challenged. So Master Fa Yun is happy to do that for us, happy to carry that on in his generation, which was long ago, and we're happy to carry that on in our own generation. Even though it's perhaps true, as it was apparently back then, that those of genuine attainment are few. It's never exactly clear, like, who they are, persons of genuine attainment. And I begin to suspect that, you know, it's not necessarily it's the same people every day. It might actually be a different cast, depending on, you know, what month it is, what building they're in, what they're wearing. I mean, who knows? Anyway, the suggestion is that whoever they are, there's not very many of them. So you could be one, I could be one, but you can be sure that it's not something that you will be able to carry around. And the minute you try to do that, you're not one. The suggestion is, of course, that eventually all will be people of attainment. Sometime. Meanwhile, there are many particularities to deal with. The actualities of our daily life and practice, which get especially poignant in retreat, in sesshin. Like the food. Probably you've all noticed that. Right? Like the afternoon tea cookie. What is this ambrosial thing I'm eating? It's like, well, it's just a cookie, but somehow something blossoms in the taste, something even noumenal. The taste is particular, but that phenomenon has a numinous quality. So now Master Fa Yun is going to go on to complain about 10 things. I don't know if we'll get through all 10. He goes on at some length. But anyway, the first one's a good one. On false assumption of teacherhood without having cleared one's own mind ground. Dear, oh dear. He says, the teaching of the mind ground is the basis of Zen study. What is the mind ground? It is the great awareness of those who arrive at suchness. Another way to say that is ground is mind. Insofar as there is any ground at all, it's mind. And I think, you know, again, this is something that can dawn in our own experience. To meet the doctrinal teachings that we've heard along these lines, for example, by the way, Master Fa Yen was quite influenced by the Huayin Qing, the Kegon Kyo, the Avatamsaka Sutra. So a lot of that appears in his teaching. And that is one of the matrices from which the notion springs that the whole world, as we encounter it, is mind. There is nothing that can be encountered from which mind is separate. So this is ground. Ground is mind. From no beginning, a moment of confusion, isn't that interesting? From no beginning at all. A moment of confusion, mistaking things for oneself, craving and desire flare up, and you flow into the waves of birth and death. The radiance of awareness is dimmed, covered up by ignorance. Routines of behavior push you on, and you cannot be free. Doesn't that sound familiar? This is like, you know, the people, some, maybe not so much anymore, but there was a trend among crusty old scholars, conservative types, to say that Zen was, Chan was not Buddhism. I think that is just ridiculous. I mean, how can you listen to this sort of teaching and not realize that this is firmly grounded in Buddha Dharma? So we say, what do we say? Delusions are inexhaustible. They're also beginningless. From no beginning, a moment of confusion. That's all it takes. Mistaking things for oneself, objects for oneself. Next thing you know, desire, craving, and you're lost in the flood. Once you have lost human status, interesting expression, you cannot restore it. That is why Buddhas emerged in the world with so many expedient methods. If you get stuck on expressions and pursue words, you will fall back into eternalism or nihilism. Again, Buddhism 1A, this stuff. With the little added spice of Zen's emphasis on there's something besides words and phrases, not in conflict with, just besides. Through the compassion of the Chan masters, the mind seal was communicated unalloyed so that people could transcend the ordinary and sacred at once without going through stages. It just got them to awaken on their own and sever the root of doubt forever. I think we're going to say that at noon, right? We're going to say transcending ordinary and sacred and dying while either sitting or standing have all depended upon what?
Strength of Zazen.
Thank you, the strength of Zazen. Now, of course, that sounds kind of like, Right, that's not really what he means. This is not muscular strength. This is more like having severed the root of doubt forever, over and over. So sometimes people say, you know, or people might think, well, that means sever the root of doubt once and for all. Yeah, again and again and again. Ordinary and sacred are transcended at once, again and again and again. People of recent times, I guess that's us, take a lot lightly. They may enter communities, but they are lazy about pursuing intense inquiry. Even if they develop concentration, they do not select a true master. Through the mistakes of false teachers, like them, they lose direction to the ultimate. They have not comprehended the faculties and fields of sense, so they have false understandings that lead them into deluded states where they lose the true basis completely. Again, a lovely mix of Chan and traditional Buddhist teaching. Comprehending the faculties and fields of sense. The old teaching of whatever can be phenomenally experienced is dependent upon organ, object, and consciousness. This is standard stuff. And not comprehending that, we again go astray, fall into the weeds, and stumble around, banging into each other. I think also at noon we will say, devote your energies to what, Donna? Devote your energies to
a way that directly indicates the absolute.
Well, that's the older translation, yeah. That points at the real. Points directly to the real thing. That's our cultivation. With that kind of cultivation, we avoid Master Fa Yan threatens here, losing direction to the ultimate. So our practice, as we like to say, is thus. Our sitting points directly at the real without our manipulation, without getting lost in doctrinal points or repudiating them, without falling in among objects or rejecting them, without reifying the self or trying to annihilate it. This practice of ours, this sitting practice, has its own compass, the compass of suchness. And if you practice, if you allow that practice to inhabit the body-mind completely, the root of doubt is severed forever. again and again. Concerned only with hurriedly striving for leadership, they are falsely called teachers. While they value an empty reputation in the world, how can they consider the fact that they are bringing ill upon themselves? Not only do they deafen and blind people of later times, but they also cause the current teaching to degenerate. Having climbed to the high and wide seat of a spiritual master, instead, they lie on iron bedsteads. This was evidently a bad thing in those days. Suffering the final shame of Chunda, who was the one who supposedly fed Buddha his fatal last meal. The final shame of Chunda, forced to drink molten copper. One of the amusements of the Buddhist hells. I don't think the Christians thought that one up, maybe not. Beware! It is not good to be complacent with oneself. The punishment consequent on slandering the great vehicle is not minor. That's only complaint number one. There are nine more. I don't know, it's 10:45. Maybe I'll just try one more. I'm just about as uncomfortable as all of you, by the way, so I don't think I'm just cruising along up here with my legs crossed, having a great time. Number two is kind of fun. On factional sectarianism and failure to penetrate controversies. The founder of Chan did not come from India to China because there is something to be transmitted. Hallelujah. He just pointed directly to the human mind for the perception of its essence and realization of awakening. How could there be any sectarian style to be valued? Now, who else talks like this? Why, our old friend Dogen says exactly the same thing. Never mind sects and schools, there's only the Buddha way, transmitted from India to China and eastward across the Great Water. One of the characteristics supposedly of Chan is this direct pointing to mind. Special transmission outside scriptural content. Kyoge Betsuden, they say. And then usually they say seeing true nature and attaining Buddhahood. These are the three characteristics of our school. And again, there's nothing in there that contradicts Buddha's teaching at all. Just a little, I consider it mostly an aesthetic emphasis. So we're not really a school, we just have an aesthetic emphasis. Right? That's a little different. And given how aesthetically different India and China are, that's not really surprising, let alone China and the US. Nevertheless, the provisional teachings devised by the guides to the source had differences and accordingly came to differ from one another. For example, the two masters, Huineng and Shanxu, had the same teacher, that is, Huangran, the fifth ancestor, but their perception and understandings differed. Hence, the world referred to them as the Southern School and the Northern School. Once Huineng was gone, there were two teachers, Xing Shi and Huairang, that is, Qingyuan and Nanyue, the two great descendants of the sixth ancestor. Qingyuan is, of course, Seigen Gyoshi in our morning lineage chant. Xing Shi, or Seigen, taught Shichen, who's also known as in Japanese, Sekito, Kisen, who wrote The Merging of Difference and Unity. And Huairang taught Master Ma, the great Master Ma, Matsu. Matsu was also called Qiangxi, and Shichen was also called Shito, or Sekito. From these two branches diverged individual lineages each occupying a region that is a geographical area. The outflow of the original streams cannot be recorded in full. When it got to Deshan, Linji, Guishan, and Yangshan, Caoshan, and Dongshan, Shuifeng, Yunmen, and so on, each school had established devices with higher and lower gradations. But when it came to continuation, their descendants maintained sects and factionalized their ancestries. Not basing themselves on reality, eventually they produced many sidetracks, contradicting and clashing with one another, so that the profound and the shallow became indistinguishable. Unfortunately, they still do not realize that the Great Way takes no sides. Streams of truth are all of the same flavor. These sectaries spread embellishments in empty space and stick needles in iron and stone, taking disputation for super knowledge and lip flapping for meditation. Sword points of approval and disapproval arise, and mountains of egotism toward others stand tall. In their anger, they become monsters, their views and interpretations ultimately turning them into outsiders, that is, people outside the way, gedojin, people outside. Unless they meet good spiritual friends, they will hardly be able to get out of the harbor of delusion. They bring on bad results, even from good causes. So we should please remember, as Dogen also reminds us, that this is not the Zen school. We have our ways and styles, but they merely serve to carry the Buddha way. If someone says to you, well, you must belong to the Zen school, you can say, excuse me, I have to correct your wrong view there. You can have a nice discussion, but please do not give rise to sword points of approval and disapproval. I used to carry a little card in my wallet. It was supposedly a quote from the Tan Qing, the Platform Sutra, the sixth ancestor, where he says, it is a fundamental principle of Buddhism not to argue. To argue is to lose the meaning of the way. So don't argue, but very quietly demonstrate your familiarity with the mind ground. Would you do that, please? He mentions a lot of very, very famous teachers: Deshan, Linji, Guishan, Yangshan, Caoshan, Dongshan, Shuifeng, Yunmen, etc., etc. All of them quite celebrated. All of them had their own kind of particularities. All of them had actualities to deal with in the midst of their innate, immediate understanding of the noumenal, the mind ground, of the ground of everything that is mind. And when you all continue your careers of guiding beings, it will be the same for you. This next one's pretty cool too, but I think maybe we'll leave that for another day. Next one's on teaching and preaching without knowing the bloodline. Maybe I'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow, because the bloodline will come into some somewhat sharper focus, because we'll have a Jukai ceremony tomorrow morning for Casey Cochran, who's a thug from Sacramento and is receiving Buddha's precepts. And so bloodline will be very much in our focus. So maybe I'll talk about that briefly, and then we will have our ceremony. And then Casey will hang around with us for a while so we can torture him. So maybe there are some questions this morning? Yes.
You spoke about pointing toward the truth.
Did I?
I think so. Sitting is headed toward the...
Oh, it directly indicates the real. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Isn't ego real? Isn't, like, the confusion real?
It's provisionally so, sure. Is that what you mean?
I'm trying to... I mean, my experience the last 2 days is that there's just so much ego everywhere. And as soon as I try to make space for it, then I try to grab that, and so...
How do you go about making space for it? What does that mean to you?
It's usually I start out by doing that,
mm-hmm.
when I see it,
mm-hmm.
and then I just try to not do that so much.
That sounds pretty good, but is something not satisfactory about that for you?
Well, I just want that to be included in the...
Oh, it's definitely included.
Okay.
Oh, sure. That's called severing the root of doubt by relax. If we're doubtful, then it makes it very hard not to relate to that stuff in some kind of like fearful way or aggressive way. But if there's no doubt, it's like, phew, let go. Yeah, it's real, but only provisionally. It's only dependent co-arising. So is everything else. So you don't have to worry about it. Besides, what else does he say? You are maintaining the essential working of the Buddha way. He says, you are. He's inviting us over and over again, sever the root of doubt once and for all, moment by moment. That's what you're talking about. Yes.
Even though it's helpful to spend this time shrinking the area of our concern to half a tatami mat, is there a danger that we come to think of practice as shrinking our... concern.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be the case?
I think so.
Hmm.
I think I at least at some point in my practice. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, in Japan, they're really into that shrinking thing, like I said. And sometimes I did wonder whether there was anything else to it for them. I don't speak the language, couldn't really relate to those kids very well. But it was a little hard to see beyond the shrinking, or Suzuki Kiroshi and his colorful expression. You gotta get that snake in a bamboo tube, man. Even though the snake wants to do this, get it in that tube and straighten it out. This is sort of their metaphor for training, because then the dimensions of the provisional self become obvious. Right? But that's not all. Right? There's also the noumenal revelation of the mind ground. And if that's missing, then all you got is an unhappy snake in a tube. So, but my experience is that the, for instance, going on retreat, very often at the end, like you yourself have been in the dining room at Green Gulch at the end of a 7-day sesshin, people. And that's kind of like the flow of energy spontaneously arising after this period of constriction. It's quite beautiful and totally alive. And in that experience, sometimes people will actually, I hate to use these expressions, realize the mind ground. That is, not so much their thinking doesn't grasp anything, but they will realize life. And that will encourage and guide them from then on. So that piece has to be there too. And that is the responsibility, among other things, well, the whole Sangha of spiritual friends, but also the so-called people who have taken on the burden of the lineage. And if, as Master Vayan says, they are deficient and warped, then, you know, stone them and throw them in a ditch and find a good one. Because that piece has to be there. Does that speak to your concern?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, don't really stone them, but, you know. Take their oatmeal away. Like, well, I should get that paper. It's hysterical. Anything else today? So get cozy on your half a tatami, you know, and try not to make any sound or any movement. Of course, that's not possible. But when you do make sound or movement, make sure that's within the crystal vessel of practice and not just kind of spraying out, you know, trying to escape here and there. Thank you very much for your effort. It's quite encouraging to me.